If only life had a remote control, you could pause or rewind. Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. Take the one-minute risk test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
President Biden warns Ukraine of a Russian invasion next month. Why are leaders there appealing for calm? Plus, the IMF cuts China's growth forecast as Beijing doubles down on market intervention and the worsening humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan.
It's a sort of domino effect. This was an economy that was built around foreign aid, and that aid was abruptly cut off.
It's Friday, January 28th. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Here's the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. President Biden has warned Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky that Russia may invade as soon as next month. U.S. officials remain unsure whether Russian President Vladimir Putin has actually made that decision, though Russia has sent medical units to the front, which Western defense officials say indicates a level of readiness not reached in past buildups. Journal national security reporter Vivian Salama is in Ukraine and says those warnings are being met with a mixed reaction.
The Ukrainian government is so worried that all of these actions are going to create panic here. They say that if people are afraid, they're going to rush the banks, withdraw their money, and, you know, not want to go to work and just kind of hunker down. And this is a big concern for them because they believe that in order to be a viable opponent to any kind of Russian attack, their economy also needs to be in good position.
Putin is scheduled to speak with French President Emmanuel Macron later today, while the U.S. has called for a meeting of the United Nations Security Council to discuss the standoff over Ukraine. A federal judge has invalidated the sale of oil and gas drilling leases in the Gulf of Mexico, citing environmental concerns. Environmental groups had accused the Interior Department of failing to properly consider the greenhouse gas emissions caused by the sale. Chevron previously identified itself as the highest bidder on several dozen tracts that were offered in what was the largest offshore oil and gas lease sale in U.S. history. Chevron has declined to comment. Robinhood shares have dropped in late trading after fourth quarter results missed estimates. The brokerage posted a loss of more than $400 million as it contends with increased technology costs and administrative expenses. Those results come even as Robinhood recorded a nearly 90% jump in year-over-year revenue, as well as a surge in retail investment clients. The brokerage now has 22.7 million customers, compared to just 12.5 million in 2020. And researchers around the world are monitoring a new sub-variant of Omicron. Known as BA2, the new variant has been detected in at least 40 countries and may be displacing the original strain of Omicron in Denmark. Dr. Maria Van Kerkhove from the World Health Organization says new variants are inevitable.
The next variant of concern will be more fit. And what we mean by that is it will be more transmissible because it will have to overtake what is currently circulating. The big question is whether or not future variants will be more or less severe.
It isn't yet clear if the new variant behaves differently to Omicron. However, the UK Health Security Agency says there's currently no evidence of it being more severe. The world's second largest economy is sputtering. The International Monetary Fund has now slashed this year's growth forecast for China from 5.7% to 4.8%, citing worsening imbalances that have delayed China's transition to a consumption-led economy. It confirms growing investor concern that more state intervention in the economy could be hindering growth. For more, we're joined by the Journal's Asia Markets editor, Quentin Webb. Hi, Quentin.
Hi there.
Quentin, how surprising is it to get this reading from the IMF?
Well, in some ways, I guess it's not that surprising because it seems to follow a series of private sector downgrades for China. So some of the big investment banks have already cut their forecasts for Chinese growth in 2022. So if you like, now we're getting that kind of an official imprimatur from the IMF as well.
Okay, so perhaps this report isn't all that surprising, but perhaps the IMF is looking at what's going on in China a little bit differently. What do they say is causing this downturn in growth?
Well, that's right. So the IMF does look at things a little bit differently. And one of the things they do is they focus a lot on structural analysis of economies. And what's central to their analysis is that actually China is delaying what it has long sought to do, which is to shift towards a more consumption-driven economy, rather than one in which heavy spending by state companies, heavy investment in infrastructure, large amounts of exports drive the economy. So what the IMF is doing here is it's sort of sounding the alarm and saying, actually, what seems to have happened is that shift has been delayed recently.
Right. And not just delaying that shift toward a consumption economy, but it sounds like cracking down on parts of the Chinese market in a way that has affected stock valuations in China. How are investors responding to that ongoing trend?
One of the big things that's been an issue for Chinese companies, both listed overseas and to some extent onshore, has been this series of kind of corporate crackdowns, things like tech, property, also after-school education. And that has had these kind of knock-on effects in some ways on consumer confidence too. So last year, China had these very strong tailwinds, you know, it had a very strong growth backdrop. And so it felt enabled to kind of pursue these kind of problems in the economy, take on these kind of capitalist excesses, if you like. But the kind of headache from that is that that does seem to have kind of worsened these problems with stagnant consumption.
That was the Journal's Asia Markets editor, Quinton Webb. Quinton, thank you so much.
Thanks very much.
Coming up, Afghanistan is facing a dire humanitarian crisis as a breakdown of the country's economy pushes millions to the brink. We'll hear from our reporter in Kabul next.
If only life had a remote control, you could pause or rewind. Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. Take the one-minute risk test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
Months after the withdrawal of U.S. and NATO troops, Afghanistan is experiencing an economic collapse and a worsening humanitarian disaster. Earlier this week, U.N. Secretary General Antonio Guterres spoke about the precarious situation in Afghanistan and said countries have a moral responsibility to come to its aid.
6 months after the takeover by the Taliban, Afghanistan is hanging by a thread. For Afghans, daily life has become a frozen hell. Time is of the essence. Without action, lives will be lost and despair and extremism will grow.
Journal reporter Saeed Shah is in Kabul now and joins us with more on the situation there. Saeed, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
You have been reporting on the unfolding humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan now for some time. Could you tell us how critical is the situation there?
The situation is getting worse and worse. A pretty severe winter has descended on Afghanistan. I mean, before they just needed to find money for food. Now somehow they need to acquire something for warmth as well as provide some sort of heat source for cooking, if that's even an option for them. And of course, with winter come more illnesses, particularly for children. So then there is the issue of medicine and possibly paying for medical care. The United Nations estimates that over half the population are in acute need of food. So that's around 23 million people. And just to explain, last month, the United Nations World Food Program was able to reach 8 million people. So they really are scaling up fast, but they need to scale up much faster.
You spoke to one man in your reporting, Wali Muhammad, the father of two deceased twins who were born premature due to malnourishment. Could you describe for us what changed for that family that brought about such a tragic situation?
As you go around Afghanistan, people have a common story of being able to get by under the previous administration, which was backed by the United States, that they were able to find work for several days a week. And now that has shrunk to maybe one day a week of work. And that sum of money that they might earn in that one day, be it $2 or $3, has to last a whole week. And you just can't square the circle with that sort of money when you have several children. And what we're seeing in Afghanistan is a huge increase in malnutrition. Wali Muhammad's wife, Palwasha, was a malnourished mother. She herself told us how little they were getting to eat while she was pregnant. As a result, the baby was born weeks early. Doctors here have explained that malnourished mothers cannot carry babies typically to full term because their bodies just can't take it. So this particular little girl was born weighing 700 grams and she very tragically passed away after 2 days. But it just shows how the economic crisis has led to people earning less money. Less money means less food on the table for the whole family and its knock-on effects to the children, to pregnant and lactating mothers.
Said, I think many members of our listening audience expected Afghanistan to face a tumultuous period as the Taliban came to power. But what has brought about such a sudden deterioration in people's wealth?
It's a sort of domino effect. This was an economy that was built around foreign aid. And that aid was abruptly cut off when the Taliban seized power. Aid made up about 40% of GDP. That had a knock-on effect throughout the economy.
You know, the U.S. government has provided decades of support to the Afghan government, and I imagine had a good read on how the economy there functioned. Could they not have foreseen the consequences of freezing financial aid and sanctioning Afghan banks as they have?
The United Nations has criticized the sanctions and the freeze of Afghan central bank assets, as have a number of governments around the world. For the U.S., they're working within a very legalistic approach of seeing the Taliban as a terrorist group, and therefore they have to freeze everything because dozens of members of the Taliban now hold senior government positions, and many of these individuals are under terrorist sanctions. And the U.S. has loosened the legal restrictions somewhat. It's issued 6 licenses, which essentially allow at least some of the humanitarian assistance to go through and even pay for some aid that would be termed development rather than life-saving assistance. The United States did build up what was an entirely aid-dependent economy, and pulling the plug on it overnight, it did end up having a very predictable outcome, which was a sort of almost total collapse of that economy.
Saeed, how are the Taliban responding to this situation?
The Taliban are not willing to recognize the problem is as severe as the humanitarian organizations, including the United Nations. Taliban does acknowledge that there is a huge problem of poverty, but they point out that they inherited a very poor country and that 20 years of American aid and aid of other countries left Afghanistan as the poorest country in Asia. Secondly, you've frozen our assets abroad and sanctioned our ability to do something about it. We don't have much of a budget. And Taliban government has essentially left the humanitarian side to the international community to deal with, to feed people, to provide shelter, to provide work while they get on with what they are most interested in, which is taking tighter control of the country, having complete security across the country, and from a military point of view, to solidify their hold on Afghanistan.
That was Journal reporter Saeed Shah joining us from Kabul, Afghanistan. Saeed, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on.
And finally, the pandemic has hit fast forward on a troubling trend for movie theaters, a decline in women willing to venture out to catch a new release. Get this, just 15% of U.S. movie tickets were sold to women 35 and up in the past year. Our entertainment reporter John Jurgensen says that while theaters have succeeded in drawing male and particularly young male audiences back into seats, the growing gender divide among moviegoers could become a self-reinforcing trend in Hollywood.
If it's all based on broad commercial potential, that's why we see a lot more superhero films and big action films that are essentially targeted towards men. And those are reliable draws for male audiences and not necessarily for women. A lot of people worry, people inside the industry and also outside the industry worry that there's a cascade effect or a ripple effect that will happen here where studios, if they worry about getting certain audiences, specifically women in the theaters, they possibly will be deterred from making films that appeal to women.
And that's What's News for Friday morning. We'll be back tonight with a new show. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening.